Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say. Your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
A week without Manchester United, it does wonders for the heart and for the mind. But despite the disappointing way we entered the international break, I think we're all keen to watch the Reds again. And it's not long now. Leicester City on Saturday before Atalanta in the Champions League next Wednesday. With no game to review this week, we talk Jesse Lingard and United's weaknesses in defensive transitions with guest Kane Smith, while Jack Tate and I discuss Newcastle's takeover, United women, what we want from the next month, and plenty more. Plus, there's an FPL update right at the end. Welcome back to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast, Series 7, Episode 10. Thank you for joining us as always. Jack, you've been enjoying the international break?
Yeah, it's been good. I think it's shown the relevance and the need for the Nations League. It's added some real spice, I think, to this international break. It's been good watching the semi-finals and the finals, three really good games.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's been pretty good.
Yeah, I think we all realised it was actually a good idea, even though, Thibaut Courtois has been complaining about the third place playoff, which I think is fair enough, actually.
Which is fair enough.
But in terms of the concept of the semis and the final itself, yeah, very enjoyable. That Belgium-France game was incredible. And yeah, victory for Paul Pogba, Rafael Varane and Anthony Martial, who obviously played a massive role in that. Kane, you're back with us. Last time you spoke to us was it after the Newcastle game, which was a pretty wonderful week, wasn't it?
I think it might have been just before Newcastle, maybe.
We were talking about Ronaldo's role in the team.
Yeah.
What have you made of, how do you reflect on what you thought his role would be in the team and how it actually has panned out?
Yeah, it's been quite expected that he's played through the middle. I think some people have been surprised that he took the game off against Everton. He came off. Yeah, I think it's been quite expected that he's played through the centre, peeled out to that left-hand side to link up with players a bit. But yeah, I think all of his goals have been exactly what we've expected from him, really. The tap-ins, which people complain about, but they're what the top strikers do, isn't they? Him and Cavani are brilliant at it, both of them.
Yeah, absolutely. This week, you're going to be talking about Jesse Lingard before some stuff on defensive transitions. Now, Lingard's away with England over these 2 weeks, and I don't know if it's gone... Not sure whether it's gone under. I think it has gone a little bit under the radar how impactful he's been for United this season. Obviously injured for the start of the season, which was a shame. Solskjaer said he would have played against Leeds otherwise. And I think Lingard is kind of the reason that Dan James was allowed to be sold in a way, as well as Cristiano Ronaldo, obviously. But he's scored twice, crucial goal against West Ham. Major mistake against Young Boys, and then a brilliant assist for Ronaldo against Villarreal. So what is it that you've noticed over the last month watching Jesse Lingard?
Yeah, well, like you say, he's actually been a big impact for us. We're winning 4 points almost on his own against Villarreal and West Ham. The assist for Ronaldo, it wasn't... I'll go into a bit more detail, but I don't think it was a surprise that he found... he found himself with the ball in the box after Ronaldo headed it back across, because I did look at it in a bit more detail, and he was on the pitch for just 6 minutes against Villarreal, I think, give or take. And he actually got a chance a couple minutes before. Ronaldo was on the right-hand side, I think, crossed it towards the box, and Lingard actually made a great run across Paul Torres. I spoke about it on, I made a thread about it on Twitter, and I was just speaking about how he found himself on the blind side of Torres. So obviously the defender's looking at where Ronaldo is. Lingard's quite good at finding little spaces in the box, and he made a really good aggressive run across the man. Obviously, because he was on his blind side, Torres couldn't react quickly enough, and Lingard got a half-decent shot away, and if I recall correctly, it was quite a good save. And the same happened for the goal minutes later. The ball was with Fred, left-back. Makeshift left-back role for him at the end of that game. And the ball towards the back post at Cristiano Ronaldo, you just saw, as the ball was crossed, Jesse Lingard was in the position between those two centre-backs. Torres couldn't see where he was. And that was mostly the reason why Lingard could react first to Ronaldo's header and get to that ball first ahead of Torres, and ultimately set up Ronaldo for the last minute winner. But it's not only what he's doing in the box, but Lingard's just such an active player when he comes off the bench and when he starts as well. But it's been quite clear that it's helped us when he's come off the bench, because I think you see him popping up in areas, helping deep in build-up, and then seconds later he'll be towards the box. And we saw that for his goal against West Ham, because I think it was the play before his goal. It was quite a similar chance. He played the ball across to Matic from a right-back kind of area, a back of a three. And then I think it was 4 seconds later, he was making a run beyond the West Ham back line for Matic to play a ball over to him. It was a bit of miscommunication, and Matic missed times the pass.
But yeah,
I think it was a good example of just how active Lingard is when he's playing. He's just all over the pitch, whether he's on the left or the right, and it makes it really difficult for the defenders to, well, the opposition team to track him.
Yeah,
and that's the same with his goal. I'll go for it, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Lingard has always kind of been the embodiment of the idea that talent can get you so far in football, but ultimately there are players who are less talented, and I'm not saying Lingard isn't talented, but less talented than others, but their work rate and their energy and their ability to find spaces does just make them better players and more impactful players and more well-liked by managers and coaches.
Yeah. Well, why was Dan James so liked by Solskjaer for so long? It was, I guess he has got good ability. No one's given that. But I feel like Dan James was liked by Solskjaer when he was here, but for that exact reason, what he said, he's an excellent worker and he'll give 100% in every single game. You know that he'll give you that. Touching back on Lingard, I think for his goal against West Ham, everyone focused on the wonderful finish, which it was. But it was also just a smart bit of movement, which I noticed, where it was actually, the ball was circulating on the left-hand side between Matic and Luke Shaw, I think. And Matic had the ball, and Luke Shaw just peeled to the touchline. Sancho, he played to Luke Shaw, and Sancho made a move out a bit wider, which pulled Koufal out a bit. And that made a bit more of space between the Koufal and the West Ham centre-back. I forgot which one it was. But and Lingard, you see him instantly notice this, and he's hovering around that area. But then when he notices that this space has been made from a good bit of movement from Sancho, Lingard instantly runs into it. And you see, if you actually look back, you see Declan Rice point at Lingard, because he's telling one of the players, cut that space out, you know, because he played with him for 6 months and he knows that he can run into those spaces and make dangerous movements. And it led to Matic finding him. And then, of course, we can't forget about the wonderful finish, which is kind of an embodiment of how confident Lingard is at the moment and in the past 6-7 months.
Yeah, Jack, I guess I think the Lingard-Van der Beek comparison is an interesting one, because it almost sums up kind of the Solskjaer management and what Solskjaer likes in that Van der Beek is a very efficient player and is good at what he does. And we're not going to talk about why we signed him if he's not Solskjaer's kind of player, but Van der Beek's very good at what he does, which is keeping the ball incredibly well, passing it and moving it. He's not always, the other United players aren't always on the same wavelength as him. And you've described him as a system player in the past, Jack. And Lingard is more in the Bruno Fernandes mold of tries a lot of things that don't always come off, but is, as Kane has said, just incessantly active. Do you think that is, it kind of sums it up, Jack, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think Lingard is actually quite well suited to this current United team for that exact reason. He gets himself into spaces that allows him to be, I think, like a main instigator of a lot of our attacks. I think Van der Beek's movement is one of his strong points. I don't think that Lingard necessarily has better movement than Van der Beek, but Van der Beek's movements are often, they're not sort of the final piece of the puzzle. You know, the spaces that Van der Beek peels into is to allow him to then carry on an attack that relies on other players also making movements that kind of complement what Van der Beek is doing. Whereas Lingard, I think, is better able to operate almost in a silo to some degree. And I think as most United players are doing at the moment, I think he does fit really well in this current team. He's obviously a very different player to Fernandes in the way that he moves and the way that I think Lingard is, you know, definitely doesn't have the vision or the sort of boom or bust that Fernandes does. Yeah. But I think in terms of the idea that they're both attacking midfielders that are very, very heavily skewed towards end product, I think they both work in this current team. Whereas I think Van der Beek is skewed more towards the build-up phase, which is not something this United team excels at.
Yeah. It is interesting as well, because I don't know about you two, but I was convinced that the right decision was to sell Lingard. And I'm not necessarily saying I'm not saying we've already been proved wrong. Well, maybe we have, because he scored twice and made a couple of assists and been very important. I don't know whether we'll see at the end of the season where we've been proved wrong. But yeah, at the moment it's looking like a good decision. For United, as he just is a great sub option. If he's content playing that role, and I can see him being, as long as he's playing in most games as a substitute, I can see him being content in that and starting a few of them. I think he'll be happy.
I think Gareth Southgate will probably be a big factor in whether Lingard's happy with that. He's spoken very openly that his main goal for the season is making it into the World Cup squad. I think if Gareth Southgate in January, you know, says either you play every week or you got no chance, I think we may have a different story. But for now, he seems pretty happy and he seems to be enjoying his football at United again.
It's possible, though, because I think for a lot of us, the reason we wanted him to be sold was not necessarily against him, but just that his value was at his all-time highest and we could reinvest that money elsewhere. If his good form continues until January and he does want to leave to find first-team football every week, then his value is going to be even higher than it was in summer. And so it also would have been proved a good decision. Okay, let's talk about something perhaps a little less positive, and United's defensive transitions, which were a problem against, well, almost everyone, but in particular, Villarreal, Everton, and probably those two in particular, Everton especially, I think.
Yeah. I wanted to start with the Lingard, start with the good, and then end with the bad. It's been a problem against quite a few teams, really. And there's multiple reasons why. Because obviously against Leeds, start of the season, it was kind of a transition frenzy game, but we came out on top in that one, and I think that was. Probably because Fred and McTominay both had really good games, if I recall. Since then, I feel like there's definitely periods of time where a lack of delaying the counter, delaying the transition. I think if you look at Pep Guardiola's sides, they'll look to delay, and then if they can't, there's a tactical foul. And obviously, the glaringly obvious one is Fred. For Everton's goal, Townsend's goal, where they were on the transition and it was Gray on the left-hand side. And you see Fred go in for that little battle against him. And really, you don't go against Fred in those little battles, because he does win them sometimes. But when you see that Gray kind of had the beating of him, he needs to reassess. He probably should be reassessing his thoughts and thinking, right, he's running towards the sideline. I'll get goal side, get my teammates back, and then we'll get in a settled shape. And I'm not sure whether it's because of instructions or whether it's just because of Fred's, he's a quite a tenacious player, that he obviously goes in for the tackle, misses, Wan-Bissaka misses, and then they're through on a really simple transition where you could either look to win the ball or look to delay the player firstly, or if you are going to go in for that tackle and you don't win it, Fred's not on a yellow card there. Take the yellow card, because it is strange, because we've went through this with Fred and McTominay last season. I'm not sure whether it's a long, obviously not too much of a pre-season, but they just don't seem as impressive in those defensive transitions. I think it was also, you didn't mention it, I think it was also a problem against Wolves, where Adama Traore, obviously he's a very, very difficult winger to stop, but like I said, delaying, it's, I think there was a situation in the first 5 minutes where Traore's inside their half, and we've got I think it was Fred and Pogba in the pivot that day, and both of them go in and try and tackle him, and he just jumps through the middle of them, and it might show a bit of the lack of the defensive midfielder that people wanted in the summer.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit of a defensive know-how to drop into the space.
Defensive midfielder is obviously a fix, or not necessarily a fix, but an improvement, and gives you a better ability to fix this is a problem. But bear in mind that we have, I don't know how many games until the January transfer window, which even in that month, it's going to be unlikely we'll see United sign anyone. But if we were to sign someone in January, we still have probably 20 games before then, maybe 15. What's the solution?
I think the solution's I don't think the solution's the 4-4-3-3, which it looked like we tried against Villarreal with it seemed like McTominay was a bit of that single pivot, and Pogba had the bit more license to go forward. But I don't think that's the solution yet. I know that it's obviously been reported that McTominay's being trying to be molded into that kind of player. But I don't think that's his game yet. Obviously, I think the best we see of McTominay is when he's going to box to box almost. So I don't think we should try that just yet, maybe until a transfer or anything. But I feel like it is to stick in that 4-2-3-1. Solskjaer definitely trusts Fred and McTominay as that pivot, but I feel like there needs to be more emphasis on them potentially not looking for that counter as much, because I feel like with the attacking players we have now, we don't need to rely on getting that ball back so quickly, where you're looking for that attack and transition. You can allow yourself to get into that defensive shape, win the ball back, and then build a steady attack rather than looking for those quick transitions. Because I feel like that's probably that is the problem sometimes, especially with Fred. I feel like it's either a hit or miss, because he either wins the ball back in a great position because he's been so tenacious and won the ball back, and then we're on a good attack. Or it's the complete opposite, and he's completely left out of position, and the other team's got quite a clear way through. There's been, like I said, against Wolves, but I can mention a few other ones. But yeah, there's been a fair few examples where that's been the case, and they've just been caught out from not delaying. But yeah, I don't think it's too easy of a fix, but hopefully with more controlling games, a bit more confidence on the ball, because I feel like after a few poor games, Fred looked like his confidence was quite down. Maybe because I feel like, going on a bit of a tangent, Fred for us over the past years has seemed like a bit of a confidence player, where when he's in that vein of form where he's playing quite well, he's extremely good for us. But then obviously confidence down, and it seems like he gets beat in duels too easily and etc. But
yeah, and we have a lot of players like that. But Jack, it might be that as Jadon Sancho comes into, well, gets his moment, as we've been talking about recently, gets his goal or assist, which boosts his confidence. But I think he has looked good in the last 3 or 4 games. But once Jadon Sancho finds improved form, once Marcus Rashford is back, as the attack gets better, it may be that we can have less reliance on, not reliance, but less need to turn to Fred and McTominay to create things by making those forward runs, which sometimes are brilliant. Against Leeds, it was fantastic, and it's good to have that in our locker. But perhaps over the next few weeks, as the attack improves and the players get used to each other, maybe the midfield and the transitions will improve alongside that.
Let's hope so.
Jack?
Yeah, I think it's got to be a big part of it. I think it's also, I think, partly how we just react in those situations too. Like, it strikes me, I think, to what Kane is saying, that so often it ends up with Fred and or McTominay sort of going into a duel. And then if they get beat, we're then exposed. And it's exactly what happened for Everton's goal in the last game. Fred gets beat by Gray and they beat one man, and suddenly, you know, it's a 3-on-2 and they're basically in on goal. I think there's an argument to say that, I think what you're saying, Kane, about sort of this delayed response is that the response to us losing possession needs to be quicker, but I think it also needs to be more controlled, in that I think instead of the response always being from Fred in particular, win the ball back immediately, and he's always going into a duel, which is necessarily a very sort of high risk thing to do. Maybe it's better actually to just try and say, I'm not going to win the ball back, but just contain, slow down the counter attack, let the other players get back. Because especially with our fullbacks playing so high up the pitch, if an opposition team can beat Fred or McTominay in midfield, suddenly they're one-on-one against either Maguire or Varane or Lindelof, whoever's playing on any given day. I think that's what leaves us so open, is that I think we need to be more content. If we are going to push players so far forward, either with doing more tactical fouls like Man City have become so good at, or it's simply just having the immediate response be contain, slow down the attack, rather than having to win the ball back immediately. Because then that just creates risks if you lose out on that duel.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's move on to one of our questions from one of our patrons. Normally these questions are in a bonus Q&A at the end of the show, but as it's the international break, we thought we'd answer them here. We've got one from Dave Shevlin, which Kane, you might be able to speak a bit on. He says, what's the best way of using Pogba now with our current squad, with our full strength available? Rashford returning, still lacking a top central defence midfielder to play beside Pogba. Is Matic the only combination with him that works? You mentioned the Wolves game with, I think, was it Pogba and Fred in that game, or was it Pogba and Matic? But it was certainly getting bypassed in there. We've obviously seen a two-man midfield, including Paul Pogba, get bypassed very easily, far too often. He's been good on the left, but we haven't got space for him necessarily there all the time. It's obviously it's a great hand to be dealt, but also tricky. Is there hope for him in a two-man midfield?
I definitely think there's hope, yeah. We've seen Pogba play great in the two-man midfield, but then over the past 8 to 12 months, we've seen him play very well on that left-hand side as well. So it is a dilemma, which he'll probably not get as much time out there when you think Jadon Sancho's grow into form, Rashford on his way back, like you said. He'll probably not get as much time out there. I'd personally like to see him play there in some matches, maybe in a few, depending on form, etc. But that is where I've seen his best form. I personally do like him when he's in more advanced areas as almost like a second attacking midfielder, basically, when he plays there. But like you said, it'll probably be deeper positions for Pogba in this throughout the season. I think he can. He can work, make it work. I think him alongside McTominay, I can imagine being something that we see quite a bit. And it will get bypassed. I feel like it will get bypassed at times. But I think you've got to pick and choose your games. And if you're playing Burnley at Old Trafford, apologies to Burnley, but we're going to have the majority of possession in games like that. And I think that those are the games where you'll see the best of Pogba when he's got the options ahead of him in Sancho, Rashford, Greenwood, Ronaldo, Cavani, can go on. But these are the games where we know what we'll probably be getting from Pogba in a lot of those kind of games. But it'll be interesting to see if he'll play in the pivot in maybe the more intense games, and if he does, how he will deal with it, because his defending is inconsistent, because sometimes I think that he defends really well. He's obviously very strong, can read the play quite well. But then sometimes, obviously, you get these defensive laps which create mistakes, which we've seen in previous seasons. But yeah, it's definitely going to be an option in the pivot going forward.
Jack, it's those defensive mistakes that are overcommitting, or I mean, he just sometimes he'll put in a great tackle because he's got those long legs which give him the ability to do so. But other times, he has a pretty remarkable inability to defend, given he's a great player in every other regard. Jack, I mean, there's not really an explanation for it, but can you see a future for him in the two man role?
I can. I think he's too good a player not to be able to play there. And we've seen some of his great performances for United in the past happen there. I think it is a case, though, of, you know, building building a better sort of way of dealing with those defensive transitions, because we know that that isn't Pogba's strength. I think we saw it was Pogba and Fred against Wolves, and that Adama Traore run that Kane mentioned has stuck in my mind for a while, when Adama picks up the ball between Pogba and Fred and just basically just manoeuvres the ball a tiny bit and goes right in between the two of them. And, you know, neither Pogba nor Fred had sort of the wherewithal to make that sort of tactical foul in that situation that would have been really useful. I think Pogba's defensive capabilities, or lack thereof, are a concern. They have to be if he plays in a two. I mean, there's that statistic that Pogba has, I think at one point, hadn't he given away our last four penalties at Old Trafford or something like that. You know, his defensive limitations are genuinely clear. And I think if he plays in a two-man midfield, we have to have some sort of caution, I think, around that defensive sort of part of his game. But we've seen him thrive there before. I think we just have to pick and choose when he plays there. You know, he can't play there. And I think this has been something that we've recognised for a couple of years now. He can't play there against the likes of, you know, Man City or Liverpool, but against teams that are going to sit back a lot more. And not only teams that are going to sit back more, but also teams that won't hit us with that kind of pace on the counter-attack. Pogba can play there and can thrive there. We've seen it before. It just has to be, I think, a lot more prior thought go into it, rather than it just being our default MO.
Yeah. The sound of your dog begging for attention is making me miss mine. Kane,
yeah, sorry about that.
It's perfectly all right. Just making me miss mine. Kane, thank you for coming on again. And thank you for your insight into Jesse and defensive transitions and Paul Pogba. We'll speak to you in a month or so about what, I guess, the fixtures and the performances will dictate. But thank you for coming on.
Thanks, guys. Hopefully good stuff.
Yeah. Hopefully. If you want to read more of Kane's work, he's on Twitter at KaneSmithMU. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, nice one. Speak to you in a bit, mate.
Cheers.
Cheers, Kane.
Cheers, guys.
Okay, let's move on to a couple more patron questions. Another from Dave, who says, have you been watching much of Ethan Laird this year? Do you think he'll be good enough to be brought in next year and move Diogo Dalot on? It's an interesting one. I haven't watched a huge amount of Laird this year, partly because United have so often been the Saturday game that is quite hard to watch their championship games with our lonely players, and partly just because I haven't felt a burning desire to watch Swansea City too much. Whether he can come in and replace Dalot, I think so, probably. Dalot and Laird, how similar are they? The only concern I have for Laird is at MK Dons, he played in a back five. I mean, it was more of a back three and he was at wing back. It was quite an attacking role. He's then followed Russell Martin, who was his manager at MK Dons, to Swansea City, and is playing in the same kind of role, which is great for his attacking ability. But I think everyone always knew that Laird was a brilliant attacking fullback. He loves to get to the byline and cut it back, and he's brilliant at doing that. He's kind of the opposite to Shaw, and maybe that, if he could have that role in United's team, maybe it would give United a decent balance, because Laird loves getting to the byline, Shaw loves crossing from deep. But the concern is that he's not got enough. It would be nice if he could play in a back four as he's going to play at United, and that would help improve the defensive side of his game. How much he has improved on that, I don't know, because I haven't watched him so far this season, but it would be brilliant if he could come back next year. Whether we move Dalot on, probably. We probably move him on. if Laird is good enough to come back, we definitely move Dalot on. If not, I think we'll probably end up keeping him around unless the Kieran Trippier links begin again, Jack.
Yeah, I think that, to be honest, I think there's a good chance that both Dalot and Laird will be around next season. Just because I think Solskjaer might be hesitant to have just Laird as sort of backup there. I guess it also somewhat depends on Brandon Williams as well, and if he comes back to United and, you know, is actually going to stay, because he's obviously on loan at Norwich currently. But I think we probably see more of a future for Ethan Laird than Brandon Williams at this point.
Yeah.
So I think if Williams moves on, then potentially Dalot and Laird can come in. But I definitely think I would expect Laird to get his opportunity in the first team next year. I think, you know, he's proven himself in the youth teams. He's now out at Swansea, which is a pretty decent level. I think we've seen a lot of players, you know, have some really good loan spells in the Championship and make it, you know, it be really good, useful experience for them. So I would expect them to come in and get some opportunities next year, pretty much regardless of what Dalot does.
Yeah. It's, yeah.
I think Dalot's also useful because he has experience playing at left back too. You know,
I was going to say.
When was it Villarreal when he switched to left back?
Yeah. It does make for, yeah, it has been useful already this season having that. Although I guess that was kind of because Telles was injured for a bit, but
yeah.
It
wasn't Villarreal when he went to left back, was it? Telles played. What game was it? Was it Everton or Villa when he went to left back? I can't remember. Whenever Shaw got injured, was it Villa, I think?
Everton is the one where Shaw went off ill, I think. Or was that Villa? I can't remember. Anyway, we've not got too much time left, so we won't spend too long dwelling on that mismemory. Final question, patron question, is from Arman, who says, will Newcastle win a Premier League title before us? My answer is no.
Great question.
Before we move on to the moral implications of that, I mean, you only have to look at City for evidence of how hard it is to actually turn money into success. They've managed it, but they brought in very good football people to do it. It took them a few years, a number of years, and a number of failed signings, a number of failed managers. It takes time. And the idea that Newcastle could go on a buying spree in January and then win the league is absolutely farcical. Or even the idea that they'll get into the top four this season is ridiculous. It's not going to happen.
I think potentially a better comparison than City is potentially Everton, actually, in more recent times.
Yeah.
Who came in, got an owner, admittedly not as wealthy as what Newcastle now have, but you know, trying to do a similar thing, a different level. A different level and also different challenge with financial fair play. I know it's FFP is not sort of the stringent rules that we all imagined when it first came in, but it does still limit you. And there are now stricter rules around inflating sponsorship. So I don't think it would just be a case of, you know, having a PIF, Saudi Arabia owned company on Newcastle shirts, paying them, you know, £1 billion a year for the sponsorship rights that Newcastle can then claim as revenue. There are stricter rules around that. Everton have sort of found that. And if it ends up being, I think what Man City had to their advantage was that they could make, when they first got these new owners, 4, 5, 6 big signings every single transfer window. And so even if you only hit on maybe 25% of those, you're still getting 2 players every year that are going to come in and be very good contributors for you. But I think what you've seen with Everton is that they, and then this year they really didn't spend any money, but even before they could really make like one big money signing every window. And then you're running the risk of it not working out. And if that player doesn't work out, then you've sort of stood still over the transfer window. So I think Newcastle will find it tough. I don't expect them to be challenging for the Champions League spots for at least 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. I can see it in 2 years. If they do it right, they can do it quickly. Because they have a couple of talented players already in the team. They've got a massive support, a big stadium, so they can generate a lot of money. And if they can sign a couple of big names, they can generate a lot more in genuine sponsorships rather than state-funded ones and in shirt sales and whatever and marketing. So it is possible, but
I think in a couple of years they'll be in that sort of Leicester, Spurs, Arsenal range where they are now,
right,
and that's sort of Europa League spots. Yeah. But I mean, obviously things can change very quickly, but at least for now, that top four looks pretty separated from the rest of the Premier League in terms of quality.
Yeah, I wish we had longer to talk about the other part of the deal. We don't, but quickly, it's. I remember being asked about it in 2019, I think, when there was reports going around. It was before United-Liverpool in October 2019, I think. And reports were going around that Saudi Arabia and PIF were interested in buying Manchester United. And at the time I thought, I don't think I'd go back to Old Trafford if that were the case. And I think I still maintain that position. On the other hand, as we've said for a few different issues in the past, I don't think it isn't football fans' responsibility to... Football fans shouldn't be held accountable for this. Newcastle fans shouldn't be held accountable for Saudi Arabia buying their club.
Especially when they're still being kept out of the process of actually having a say on how their club is run. If you want fans to have some responsibility in this, then give them a stake in the club.
Yeah, it's the responsibility of the Premier League and the FA and the government, and they have shirked that responsibility in a massive way and chased the money again for... Well, it means another good Premier League team, and some might argue that's for the benefit of football, but I don't think that outweighs the negatives. It's to the detriment of football that even more than before, and this isn't the first time, and it shouldn't be seen. I don't think this should be seen as a turning point, because it's happened before. We've got Qatar at PSG, and we've got Abu Dhabi with City, but it's another step towards the only people being able to buy and succeed in football being nation states. And that is a horrendous situation to be in, and is a massive failure of the last 25 years of football governance.
I think on the governance part, I think something that's sort of flown a bit under the radar here is that through all of the media coverage of, you know, the criticism of the Saudi-led takeover being, you know, treatment of women, treatment especially of the LGBT plus community, that actually was never the reason the Premier League was stopping and delaying this takeover from happening. Yeah. This takeover was only delayed from the Premier League side because Saudi Arabia had banned Qatari-owned beIN Sports from broadcasting there. And once that issue was resolved, then the takeover was allowed to happen. So, you know, the media has whipped up that storyline, but actually for the Premier League, that was never even on the docket for discussion, which I think is disgusting, frankly. I think second, you're right that, you know, we are moving to a point in football where it does seem like nations are really the only ones that are able to afford to buy a football team at this point, because I think most people acknowledge that owning a football club isn't going to make you very much money. And even if it does, it's certainly not the most financially worthy investment that you can make. And so it takes either someone like Daniel Ek, who is obviously the Spotify owner, has been rumored to want to buy Arsenal, who is willing to throw a lot of money at something purely for the love of doing it, or someone or an organization, a country that has something to gain from it. And in this case, it's all about, you know, cleaning up that image. Sport washing has sort of been used a lot this week, and I think this is a perfect example of it, you know, trying to clean up an image of a nation sort of hiding behind potential success of Newcastle United to be a distraction from what's going on in Saudi Arabia. And it's not just these owners. I also want to point that out. You know, they get more attention because they are a country, but, you know, let's not pretend that a lot of the individuals that own Premier League teams, like the Glazer family, like the John Henry at Liverpool, you know, like Roman Abramovich at Chelsea, their money is also tied up in places that I don't think we like to admit. And I think we sort of gloss over that because they aren't a country, but there's all sorts of links from all of those families having money in really, really awful places and funding organisations that, you know, we would never claim to support. So it's not just this. And so I don't think it's right to blame Newcastle fans. I think, to be perfectly honest, I think it's completely understandable why so many fans are jubilant about this, because they've had a torrid time of it. And it, as you said, Harry, it's not their responsibility, quite frankly.
I get them being jubilant about Ashley leaving, but I don't think it's a majority, but for the pretty sizable minority of people who have already been convicted, like the sports washing has already worked. It's done.
Right, but I think my point is that especially when they're coming in, not only promising investments in the football team, but investments in the area too. When you've been left behind for this long in an area that has been, you know, falling behind the rest of the country for, you know, 20, 30 years at this point, you become basically willing to accept money wherever it's going to come from, I think. And I think it's understandable why you would be happy about that, regardless of where it's coming from, because when you go through sort of the right processes, you get nothing.
Yeah. No, I understand it, but I don't agree with it. I understand people being happy about what's going to happen to their football club on the pitch, but the people celebrating with Saudi Arabian flags and praising PIF and the Saudi Arabian and calling them His Excellency and whatever, that's not the way forward. You can very much celebrate Mike Ashley leaving and a new future for your club, but also retain some perspective. This idea that Newcastle fans had it harder than any others in the country is complete bollocks. They've basically been a mid-table Premier League side with a couple of relegations over the last 15 years and had some success, got near the top four. The idea that that's worse than Bury, Macclesfield or Oldham or even Sunderland down the road, they've had it far worse than Newcastle. And the idea that Newcastle have a divine right to success, again, it's just bollocks. They haven't won a Premier League. They've never won a Premier League. They haven't won a top flight title for decades and decades.
And Newcastle for a long time have been a club, I think, whose stature in English football, I at least personally think, has been inflated purely because they have a big stadium. And, you know, they were a good side in the 90s, obviously had Alan Shearer, who, you know, really put them on the map. But if you look back through their history, they're not a club, I think, you know, we're not talking about a Liverpool or a United or an Arsenal sort of falling from being a dominant team in English football to now becoming a mid-table team. Like, this is most of Newcastle's history like this. So I don't think it's, you know, this isn't, they've had a bad time of it under Mike Ashley because he hasn't run the club in a way that I think we would be happy with. But the results on the football pitch haven't been that out of step with what Newcastle's history has been over the last 30 or 40 years. Like you're saying, there are plenty of other places in the country, both in terms of the football team and in terms of the actual area and sort of what's gone on with the politics behind their sort of demise, that would also be, you know, very worthy and deserving of this sort of investment. So I understand why fans are happy about it. I agree with you that I think you can be happy about that, what the end result is going to be, without sort of, I don't know what the word is, without glorifying, I guess, the people that are going to be doing it. I think that's sort of where the difference comes. But I thought the most ridiculous part that I saw of this was the Newcastle have a United with Pride organisation, sort of LGBTQ plus organisation, a part of the football club. And their statement on it, I thought, was just a sack of shit, basically. And it's just another example of
a disgrace of people being bought out.
Yeah, exactly. And if you are an organisation that have a platform with some of the fans, you cannot just completely gloss over something that goes completely against everything that you stand for in exchange for some success on the pitch. You just can't do it.
I think the key is that you can carry on supporting your club, as many City fans have done, and you can celebrate their success if it comes, but you can still use your voice as a fan to go against your owners. You can celebrate what their money leads your club to do and still criticise the owners, as Manchester United fans do. Not at all in the same way. We criticise our owners because they're bad for our football club. It's not because they have a terrible human rights record or it's completely different, but you could support your club while criticising people and while amplifying the voices of Saudi Arabians and people from Yemen who have been mistreated by the Saudi Arabian government. Anyway, we better move on. I'm sure it's something we'll come back to in future. Right, let's talk very quickly about United Women. It was a Manchester derby last weekend. 2-2, entertaining game. Probably 2 points dropped for Mark Skinner's side. City went down to 10 players in the 35th minute, but then took the lead through Bunny Shaw. United scored 2 in the 72nd and 75th minute to go ahead through Alicia Russo and Lucy Staniforth, but then Ellen White tapped home to make it to draw the scores level again. 2 points dropped. The midfield wasn't really involved at all. That was probably the weakest part of United's game, but a decent derby result to move on. And United, I think, are fourth in the WSL table after 5 games. I think I've remembered that correctly. Jack, before we wrap up, let's very quickly talk about Leicester, but also in the next, tell me in 30 seconds, over the next 4 weeks, we've got loads of big games. There's another international break in November before the next international break. Not in terms of results, but in terms of what you see on the pitch. What do you want to see from Manchester United?
I want to see Jadon Sancho break his duck. I want to see United keeping some clean sheets and dealing better with transitions. And I want to see us figure out a partnership and a way of playing in midfield that can actually keep us playing well in attack, but not get beaten so quickly on these defensive transitions.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I want to be excited by home games, because the four we had in consecutive 11 days were not exciting enough. Although we did have a brilliant last minute winner in the Champions League, which was exciting, but the rest of the game wasn't particularly so. Yeah, I agree on all that. You put it well, so I won't add my own words. Leicester, Saturday, 3 p.m. Strange again to be playing at 3 p.m. for what should be a decent game, actually.
Yeah, of all the games we've had recently, this doesn't feel like the one that should be at 3 p.m.
Yeah.
But
yeah. The away record, will it continue? We all forget about the away record, I think. It was kind of celebrated quite a lot when we beat the record by beating Southampton and then extended it against Wolves. But I think since then it's kind of been forgotten about, which I think it's not like...
Well, partly because we've barely had an away game in the last month.
It's also because like you don't want to talk about it all the time, and it doesn't matter too much, but it is still a significant achievement. Leicester, a couple of injuries and very much out of form. We've got to win this, and we have to win it well. And I don't think we can have any excuses for not winning it either. Although they're a good team, but they're out of form. We've got to go and win it.
Yeah, we have got to go and win it. I mean, I feel like our matches against Leicester are always just incredibly tight. I think we've seen in the past couple of years, I think us and Leicester have been so closely matched in previous seasons. I think that just isn't the case now. You know, this team has gone very clearly forward another couple of steps. And I think Leicester have very clearly gone backwards a couple of steps. But I also think that, especially with Vardy still playing very well, regardless of Leicester's bad form, they are still set up to cause us some issues. And I can just imagine a Vardy sort of hammer blow at some point in this game.
Yeah, there'll be no Fred or Cavani, I don't think, because Brazil play Uruguay in the early hours, English time, in the early hours of Friday morning. And obviously we play on Saturday. So presuming they play in that, and I don't think they're going to be allowed to come back early. Even if they don't play in it, they're not going to be able to play on the Saturday for jet lag as much as not playing two games in 2 days, which will have an impact. I expect McTominay and Matic has never seen, I mean, Fred and Matic has never worked. We haven't seen McTominay and Matic too much, but it might have to be a McTominay Pogba kind of game.
Yeah, maybe Kane will get his wish and see those two together. I think that probably is the way that we'll go. I don't see Matic and McTominay starting together, to be honest. And I think Pogba and McTominay make sense to start this game.
I say Leicester have injuries, but now you think about it, Maguire's still out. Varane hobbled off. Yeah, which means it could be Lindelof
and Bailly.
I don't know how fit Bailly is. Otherwise, it's going to be, if Varane's
could
not
be Lindelof
there, otherwise
and Phil Jones.
I know, yeah. For his first game since Tranmere. And then Shaw, I think, will be fit.
Who else do we actually have? There's actually no other centre-backs other than in the youth team, because Twanzebe's out on loan. So, no, he's actually
be,
it, isn't it?
If someone
it
had to step up, it'd be Tedemengi,
yeah.
Who I think has been training with the England senior squad a couple of days over the last week. He's with the under-20s, but yeah. We'll see on Varane. No update as of yet. I'm not 100% sure. I think he should be fit. So it would be Lindelof and Bailly for the first time in a long time. If Maguire is out, we'll see about Varane. So yeah, we could have quite a makeshift back six. Wan-Bissaka, Lindelof, Bailly, Shaw, McTominay, Pogba. It's still good enough. But yeah, no Cavani as well. But let's hope it's good. Jack, final thing, fantasy. How's it going? Who's leading and how are we doing?
Yeah, so now through, 8 weeks, I think, of the fantasy season, Maddison Latter is currently leading pretty comfortably, actually. The league is very, very tight, but Maddison has a 17-point lead over Cameron Akinpong in second, in the NYC in third, and then to round out the top five, got Ike Yagoala in fourth and Ian McLean in fifth. It then gets very, very tight. Harry, you and I think we're doing pretty well. I'm happy with this personally. So, Harry, you're in 18th and I'm in 22nd. There's 7 points between us. And that's out of a league of 196. So, I think if you're inside the top 50, I think you're doing really, really well. And it's very, very tight. There's between second and 50th, there's only 40 points or so. So it's very close at the moment. But yeah, we're doing pretty well. I'm happy with where we are.
I'm happy. I'm above you. That's all that matters.
no, I thought I was going to get you last week, but you captained Salah and you got me right at the end.
Yeah, this is, I mean, I only started playing fantasy last season for the first time during lockdown, because I always hated it before, because I hate the fact that I had to have Liverpool or City players in. I don't have any, I have no City players, but I have a couple of Liverpool players, and I just leave Salah as captain for the whole time, just so I don't have to ever think about it. But it could be time for a wild card.
I'm sort of
this
like
week.
That
we'll
the other way. I'm like always so hesitant to captain United players, because actually if it goes wrong, it's going to go doubly wrong, because we'll not
that's, yeah, that's
get
why
a bad
I do
result,
it.
But my captain also won't get any points.
Yeah, that's I captain Liverpool players to soften the blow of them winning.
Yeah.
Because I know if Ronaldo scores, I'm going to be happy anyway. I don't need fantasy to make, it's not going to make me more happy. So I might as well just celebrate it and captain Liverpool player to soften the blow. And it's going okay so far, because Salah is outrageously good and incredibly annoyingly good. All right, let's wrap things up. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. For more from us throughout the week, for our reaction to the Leicester game, and we'll be back after that, obviously, recording next Sunday or Monday, so you'll be able to hear us Monday evening again. But for more from us throughout the week, you can find Jack on Twitter at
UTDTait, T-A-I-T.
You can find Kane, who was on earlier, at Kane Smith, that's C-A-I-N, Smith, M-U, on Twitter, and you can find me at Harry Robinson 64, and the podcast itself at UTD Weekly Pod, that's P-O-D at the end there. Thank you to Dave Shevlin and Armand Dugal for your questions. Thank you to the rest of our patrons for your continued support to allow us to do this and a little bit more. And thank you to you for listening. If you enjoy the show, leave us a review. Otherwise, have a great week. Goodbye.